And welcome to Cross Defense on this Monday, May the 18th. Unique program where we talk about the intellectual challenges to the Christian faith of people of all ages. And today we have one of those which I love because it's a double dipper. This is a program that we can air on two of the programs that I'm privileged to host, not only on Cross Defense, our apologetics show, but because it's an apologetics book we're going to talk about today, I'll air it in the future on Book Talk, our book review program. And so we welcome in Cold Case Christianity, a homicide detective investigates the claims of the Gospels. Its author, J. Warner Wallace, is with us today. Welcome to Cross Defense, Jim.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, we appreciate you coming on because, as you know, more and more of Christians out there are getting into apologetics as they should. It's biblical. It's mandated by us. And the world, especially in our time, needs this because we are under so many challenges from so many places that people think it's just a myth and on and on. And so your story is a neat one. Fascinating evidence it is that the Holy Spirit took a devout atheist who happened to be a cold case detective, and he made him a Christian, and not just any Christian, an avid apologist. What forensic evidence, Jim, convinced you to be a follower of Jesus Christ?
Well, I think this is part of it. You know, it's part of it is really trying to understand what qualifies as evidence to begin with. And that's, I think, a largely misunderstood. You know, there's this idea that, well, gosh, if I don't have the direct physical forensic evidence, that I can't really accept any claim. You know, I've got to be able to touch it and analyze it. And you know, if you don't have DNA or fingerprints or something in this category, then I can't accept any truth claim. And of course, my cases, they're cold for a reason. They're cold because, number one, I don't typically have any eyewitnesses who are still alive who can tell me what happened. I don't have good forensic evidence, DNA, or any other kind of biological scientific evidence. I don't have fingerprints. These are things that I don't have, and this is why they're cold to begin with. If we had those kinds of pieces of evidence back in the day, they would have been solved immediately. And so what we have to do is come together and learn how to assemble cumulative indirect evidence cases. Now, indirect evidence is really, there's two forms of evidence. Direct evidence, which is just eyewitness testimony, and indirect evidence, which is everything else. So I'm really in the business of assembling cumulative indirect cases. The other word for indirect evidence, it's got another name which I think is a bit of a pejorative here in our culture, and that is circumstantial evidence. In other words, in the cases across America, and I can tell you that in all of my cases, I've built my cases on entirely circumstantial evidences. And this is what 70% or more of cases in America are made completely circumstantially. And so we look at this and we say, okay, well, once you understand the categories of evidence, then it's possible for us to say, well, do we have sufficient evidence to believe that Christianity is true, even though we may not have DNA or fingerprints or some of the other things that we tend to think of as evidence, which are really very rare in criminal cases?
You know, the only time in my life, Jim, that I've ever been on a jury some years ago, I always wanted to be because I thought I would be a good, fair juror. I got called to one. It was quite a case. Alleged attempted double murder, double kidnapping. Was in Michigan, so the defendant was charged too of a new law. He'd come out of prison and had used a handgun. So some serious charges. And I remember at one point in the jury selection, the district attorney asked, maybe there was 20 of us left at that time, how many of you watch and follow any CSI programs? And I was one that hadn't. I never have. But I understood kind of what they were. And so five people raised their hand, and he asked each one of them individually.
Before you even answer, let me just guess why he's asking this question, because we do the same thing, right? We ask this question all the time. Was he asking the question because he was going to ask you don't actually believe some of the stuff that you see on that show. Because typically we have to ask our jurors if they watch those shows and if they believe that these kinds of things can actually be done in real cases, because there's this thing called the CSI effect where people actually believe that these things can be done and they're disappointed when they find out we didn't do any of those things.
Yeah, even more what he asked pointedly was, do you demand that you have some kind of that evidence before you return a guilty verdict?
Yeah.
And three out of the five said yes, and he said, I want these removed. And the rest
exactly
of us,
right.
And then he told the rest of us, very rarely like you did, he said, do I have any cases where we have any of that? That's TV. That's Hollywood most of the time.
Yeah, I can tell you this is exactly what I experience. I write about it a lot at my website at coldcasechristianity.com, because I think that what we have is this false sense that you can only, and I hear this from atheists, and I never took this approach, okay, because I knew enough about evidence to not be able to say something this foolish, but I sometimes will hear atheists say, look, you've got no good evidence, because, and it's clearly because they don't understand what qualifies as evidence to begin with. And how I usually say it is, everything qualifies. When I'm talking to somebody, everything that you may say is going to be evidential. And guess what? The things you could have said but chose not to say, that's also evidence.
So, or even as we're going to talk, Jim, I like it a point, and we don't want to give it away now because I want to save it for later on. You talk about, which I really enjoyed, hanging on every word and really listening to every word and going, now, did that sound a little weird or out of place or so forth, or, you know, grab me? So that's important. And so why is it usually the case in the cases that you did of the cold case nature that it was circumstantial?
Well, and a lot, here's why, because you only have these two categories, right? So circumstantial is also called indirect. The only form of direct evidence we have are eyewitness accounts, where an eyewitness can come in. Now, I have had eyewitnesses who can come in and give me something that's not really related to the activity of the suspect. But when you have a simple direct evidence case, what you typically have is one or two witnesses who can come in and say, yep, I saw the suspect on that day, he went over and then he shot her, and then blah, blah, blah. And they're describing what the suspect did on the day of the murder. That's a direct case. You can do that with one piece of direct evidence. If you've got a compelling witness who stands up during cross-examination, guess what? That one witness could be all you need, one piece of direct evidence. On the other hand, if it's indirect, if I'm going to make it by a large body of indirect pieces of evidence that all point to the same reasonable inference, well, then I'm going to need a much larger, larger the set of evidences, the more compelling the inference. So I think what we do here is we look at the cases I run, because they're cold, because there was no witness to the crime 30 years ago. And that's why it didn't get solved easily 30 years ago. Largely, my cases are all of the secondary type, where all I've got is a large body of evidences that point to the most reasonable inference. And so what we do is we spend time in front of juries. And this is why your set of prosecutors and the judge in your case was really asking these important questions, because we need to know, are you jurors going to be able to realize that circumstantial evidence is powerful? And we usually give examples of circumstantial evidence, and we give some analogies, and we're looking for jurors that are smart enough to be able to say, okay, I get it. If I've got these 80 pieces of the puzzle, if I put them together, I've got the whole puzzle. I don't need to have the whole puzzle delivered to me assembled. I can actually assemble it myself.
Isn't it the case in most of these trials too, Jim? I know the one that I was in, and you know the famous ones that I and everybody else pretty much had watched on TV, where when they stop and take the jury out of the room and back to the jury room, I know we jurors, we knew what they were arguing about in that courtroom. They were arguing, should such and such a piece of evidence be allowed into evidence? And that's an important part of the trial, isn't it? To pick what evidence, according to, I believe it's rules of evidence, law on evidence, should be allowed for the jury to consider.
Yeah, and a lot of that is argued well before the jury selection even occurs. They'll discuss some of that before the trial even starts, before they even select a jury. But along the way, there are, you know, someone will try to bring something in at the last minute, something will come up that changes the evidence set a little bit, or something will be discovered in examination of a witness, and then there's, so you'll start to stop along the way and ask certain questions of the judge, and you don't want the jury to be, you know, kind of prejudiced by this argument one way or the other. So we take the jury out, and then we just make those kinds of arguments are made in front of the detectives and the prosecutor and the defense attorneys. That's going to happen outside the BS. So I think it's one thing we can look at is that there are certain categories of evidence that we would say are fair and certain ones that aren't. If something is more prejudicial than it is probative, in other words, if it's more likely to cause you to dislike our defendant, even then it is going to give you some important piece of evidence about our defendant, then sometimes if it's more prejudicial than probative, they'll take something out. Also, if you've got something that's going to make your heart kind of cry out for the victim, and it has got less evidential value, well, then we're not going to try to slant the jury toward the victim that way also. So there are certain kinds of evidences we have to really be careful about. But I can tell you, when making the case for Christianity, I've had people say to me, look, you cannot, you know, in trials, we do not allow the testimony of witnesses who are not able to come into the courtroom and testify for themselves. If you said, hey, my uncle told me 30 years ago that this happened a certain way, but my uncle's now dead, well, I'm not going to be able to come in and testify about what my uncle said because my uncle's not available for cross-examination. And we want to make sure that every witness that comes against a defendant can be cross-examined by. That's the right of the defendant. So why should we trust them that the Gospels, when we don't have access to the Gospel writers, should be accepted as eyewitness testimony, should be accepted as evidence, when we wouldn't accept secondary, call it hearsay, testimony in a criminal trial? And of course, we have to say, well, the rules of history are different than the rules of criminal trials for a good reason. The rules of criminal trials are there to protect at an extreme price the rights of defendants. We would rather falsely, we don't want to falsely convict somebody. So we would rather convict, say 10 guilty people go, than falsely convict one innocent person. So we slant the rules in favor of the defendant. But if you were to say, I could not accept the secondary witnesses that are not available to me anymore, well, then you can't know anything about history, including your own personal history. You could not even know or accept anything about your great-grandparents based on the testimony of your grandparents. You know, you can't look at it that way. You've got, for history, the rules are slightly different because we accept always the statements, second, third, fourth-generation statements are allowed for history. They're not allowed in criminal trials.
Do we not, too, Jim, with history and with our trials in our judicial system, do we not see evidence, and then we have different narratives that try to explain that evidence and match up with that evidence as the, what would you say, the more accurate descriptive narrative of that evidence? And I know in my case, we had the same evidence, both the prosecuting attorney and the defense attorney, but they told two completely different stories. And I can tell you, there was a big turning point for all of us, because I remember when the district attorney heard their narrative, and then he, in his rebuttal, he showed us a piece of evidence that he said, if you look at this, I think you will see that it totally refutes their interpretation of the evidence, their narrative that it cannot be true. And I remember we all looking at it and kind of gazing at each other, you know, because you couldn't talk, and saying, wow, I kind of know whose narrative, whose explanation of this evidence matches the real evidence that we're seeing before our eyes.
No, that's a great point. I'm so glad you brought that up, because I talk about this a lot too. I think what happens sometimes is that as Christians, if we're not well versed in what the other side is arguing, sometimes we'll hear an objection to Christianity that's so robust and articulate and seems to be supported by a number of witnesses that, you know, they'll bring in the testimony of this scientist and the testimony of this archaeologist, and they're kind of shaken by the fact that the other side could even present a case at all, especially when it's this articulate and it's got its own set of witnesses. But trust me, in every criminal trial I've ever worked, the defense attorney doesn't just wait for our 8 weeks of presentation to be done and then the criminal trial gets up, you know, the lawyer gets up and for the defense and says, oh, my gosh, that was a spectacular prosecution. I'm speechless. There's nothing I can say. No, of course not. Instead, he now begins his 8-week presentation with his own witnesses of an entirely different counter-narrative, trying to explain the same set of evidences, but from a different perspective.
And sometimes for a period of time, too, Jim, it sounds kind of believable and true. And, and you're kind of swept up until, you know, you hear some fine points and ask questions. Is that where you were heading?
Well, I can tell you this. I've actually had them sound very convincing, only later on to find out that, you know, they lose the trial and the jury comes back against them. And then at that point, the defendant confesses to the entire crime. So we now know, after all the time we spent in trial, that the entire narrative of the defense was not true because the defendant has now, after losing, has now confessed to it. We had that happen before sentencing in one case. So again, here's my point. There's not a mystery here. We now know that that narrative they offered was false. But it sure sounded compelling at the time. And there were some moments there where we wondered, would the jury be fooled by this? So my whole only point here in kind of analogizing this to the Christian worldview is, for those of us who are believers, we're in a culture right now which is offering lots of counter-narratives. That's fine. But every defense attorney can do this. Just because somebody offers a defense, even an articulate defense with its own set of witnesses, they called witnesses to the stand on that case. Witnesses who tried to say that our evidence was being misinterpreted. But I can tell you, all of it we know is not true. He is guilty. He confessed to it. So when you hear somebody present a robust defense or a robust counter argument against Christianity, it doesn't mean it's true just because somebody can offer a defense.
I like this. Can we use this in our apologetic toolbox, Jim, that sometimes we should not be so quick to discount the opposition's narrative, and especially to tell them, don't discount ours real quickly until you check it out. You know, example that I was thinking of here recently, I entered college as a freshman in the turbulent mid to late 60s. And one of the few textbooks I have from my freshman year was I took a class in cultural anthropology. And so the book is called The Evolution of Man by a PhD at Harvard, who said that he has convincing evidence, scientific evidence, that evolution is a fact. It's not a theory. It's a fact. And if you don't believe this, you're an idiot. And then he proceeded to present all this, what he thought was convincing fossil evidence. And that fossil evidence since 1967, every single bit of it has been proven to be irrelevant, and some of it even very humorously not even relevant to the task at hand. My favorite was Nebraska man, which all they turned out they had was a tooth, and they thought it was a tooth of a prehistoric ape man. That's all they had was a tooth found in Nebraska.
Right,
and so
right.
they had an artist visualize and anatomical people what the jaw might look like, then what the neck, what the spine. Oh, my goodness, we have the ape man. So they were going crazy over this. After more scientific evidence of that tooth, it turned out to be the tooth not of a human being, but of a prehistoric pig.
Right, exactly.
And no, I still got that to kind of say what you were saying is sometimes you hear the evidence, you think this is pretty hard to refute, but let all the evidence have its way with the jury, right? And especially each individual that we're trying to share the truth of Jesus with, and say, keep an open mind here, because sometimes, what you see, what you hear isn't really the truth.
Well, what it comes down to, remember that science doesn't tell us anything. Scientists tell us things based on what they discover in the science. And your presuppositions can really determine how you evaluate a science. And even the same thing is true. Archaeological findings don't tell us anything. Archaeologists do. So
there you go.
An archaeologist who's saying, I'm basically what he's doing is he's interpreting the evidential data. So the evidential data, if it's in science or archaeology or whatever it may be, This doesn't tell us anything. It's interpreters of the data that tell us something. And remember, not everyone who tells you something is neutral in the game. This is also true for Christians, but to be very, very careful here. I mean, it works both ways. This is a knife that cuts both ways. And so we have to remember that in the end, the evidence gets presented. The prosecution has a view of the evidence. The defense has a view of the evidence. And guess what? The people who are in the jury box, these are folks who are not professional jurors. We allow lay people here in this country to hear the case. And I love that because we sometimes think, well, I can't even assess whether the evidence for God or the evidence for Christianity. I don't have a PhD in ancient languages. I don't have a PhD in manuscript evidence. I don't have a PhD in archaeology or any of the sciences. Really? Well, the people we put in the jury box don't have that stuff either. As a matter of fact, I'm tempted to resist PhDs in the jury box because sometimes then your presuppositions, your pride, your kind of headiness gets in the way of clear thinking. What I'm looking for are passionate lay people who can sit in. It turns out if you're a lay person who's interested and smart enough to be able to even pay attention long enough, you're going to be just fine in a jury because that's what we're looking for. And the same is true for those of us who are assessing the Christian worldview or even making a defense of the Christian worldview. We don't have to be trained PhDs to be able to assess the evidence.
So if we enter in with an open mind and inquisition, wanting to know, and not just buffalo us with big terms to ask, what does that mean? And, inquiring minds want to know this and that, we'll do well, kind of like a juror would do.
That's right.
To ask a lot of questions, even after you've heard the evidence and the narrative, ask, well, there seems to be contradiction here. There seems to be a gap here. What does that mean, to the outcome is important, is it not?
Yeah, it really is. I think what happens in jury trials, jurors are allowed to reassess, to have further access to the testimony of key witnesses, the witnesses we bring in a trial. So at some point in the jury deliberation, if they've forgotten something that an expert witness says, they can ask the clerk to have read back. Then somebody will come in, their court reporter will come in, they'll read back the testimony of that expert witness. Well, it seems if we're really interested in what we believe as Christians, I have an entire home library, which I basically bought used. I mean, almost every book in my library right now, as I'm looking at my shelves, almost every book in this library is a used book I bought for like pennies on the dollar. And these are all the books, which are all current books in a variety of fields from textual criticism all the way to the sciences. These are my expert witnesses. And if I've gotten stuck and I'm not quite sure of an answer, I ask for readback. I basically go back to the shelves and I pull out those. Now, most of us, if you asked, well, gosh, who won the Super Bowl in 1982? We know which websites to go to almost immediately to get that information. But how many of us as Christians have asked a question about our Christian faith would really know where to go online to get the answer? Or really would they have that text sitting on their shelves? There are things we are that interested in. Are we that interested in what we believe as Christians so that the resources, if we don't have them memorized already, they're right at our fingertips? And that's the thing we're trying to change as casemakers. As you know, this is why you see this growing movement of Christian apologetics, a word that most of us don't like. But it's really about, can you make the case for what you believe?
I think too, Jim, and maybe you agree, that Satan does a real number on Christians where he makes them think that they have to be an expert in all these areas that you've been describing, some of them. And if they can't keep it all in all of them in their noggin and keep it straight, they shouldn't go out and defend the faith, you know? And as you said, no, you keep a library and you have experts, and it's always good to say, well, let me check on that and get back to you. And as you expressed, so many times we hear in jury deliberations that they've asked to re-see evidence, to look at it again, to re-look at the testimony that went along with that evidence, to get it in there. We're going to take a quick break here, and when we come back, we're going to talk more with Jim Wallace, who's a cold case detective turned Christian and an apologist, and written a wonderful book on that. And he believes there's a lot of parallels, a lot of correlation between the principles he used in cold case homicide investigations and presenting the case for the claims of our beloved Christianity. So when you come back, we're going to talk more about that. And we also remind you that we're going to have a direct link on the archive of this show where you can obtain a copy of Cold Case Christianity for yourself and for your friends. They make wonderful gifts. Stick with us here on Cross Defense. We're going to be right back after you listen to these important messages.
Hi, Craig D'Onofrio here. I want to invite you to join me Monday through Friday at 5 p.m. for Reformation Rush Hour. We'll have some of today's most interesting and intelligent people on the show. We'll talk about news that affects your faith. We'll look at the world around you and talk about how it interacts with Christianity. And we'll have a good time doing it all. This is the fastest hour in radio as you drive home Monday through Friday, 5 p.m. right after Issues Etc. on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Worldwide KFUO is the most trusted place for sacred music of the church every night. Weeknights after evening prayer, you can hear sacred music on KFUO in St. Louis, streaming online at kfuo.org. Our online stream is in high-quality stereo, so you can hear the difference wherever you listen, on your computer or Wi-Fi radio, and on your smartphone. We're Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news for 90 years.
We read in John 21:15, "When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, 'Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?' He said to him, 'Yes, Lord, you know that I love you.' He said to him, 'Feed my lambs.'" This May, join us in focusing on seminary formation, which takes seriously our Lord's bidding to feed my lambs. Find out more at lcms.org/themes/May.
I'm Larry Troxell from Quincy, Illinois, also pastor of St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Bowen, Illinois. My wife Donna and I are day sponsors of KFUO because we are thrilled to have the opportunity to proclaim the gospel of Jesus through this ministry around the world. The station is now celebrating its 90th year, and the Lord continues to open doors for the proclamation of His Word through this station. You may be a part of this marvelous ministry by becoming a day sponsor also. Our day sponsorship is for my wife's birthday. You can pick a date that's meaningful to you also. You will have an important part in the ongoing ministry of this station in carrying the good news about Jesus throughout the world.
This is Mary Schmidt. To be a day sponsor, call me 314-996-1518.
Hi, this is Rich Robertson, President and CEO of the Lutheran Church Extension Fund. We are excited to walk alongside Lutheran Church Missouri Synod members and ministries as they witness and perform works of mercy and compassion around the world. Investments with LCEF provide the exceptional financial resources used daily to build faith communities and serve God's people. Our loans and ministry support services are available to LCMS congregations, schools, and organizations, as well as rostered church workers. Visit LCEF today.
Let Worldwide KFUO help you get the word out about your next church, school, or organization event. By including your event in the KFUO datebook, it will be announced on the air throughout the day. Send your event information via email to jennyw@kfuo.org. That's jennyw@kfuo.org. Or call 314-996-1515. Be sure to include date, time, location, and contact information. The KFUO datebook is a public service of listener-supported Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Was the New Testament day of Pentecost a unique event, or should we expect it to be repeated today? Monday on Issues Etc., we'll look forward to Sunday morning with Dr. Carl Fakencher talking about the first Pentecost. We'll also discuss the commandment, "You shall not commit adultery," with Pastor Paul McCain.
Issues Etc., live weekday afternoons from 3 to 5 on KFUO.
And we're back on Cross Defense. The question of apologetics, intellectual challenges for the Christian faith. I'm your host, Pastor Rod Zwanitzer, thanking our underwriter of both Cross Defense and Book Talk, where this apologetics book will air on both, Luther Academy. Check them out, lutheracademy.com. They do some great things for the body of Jesus Christ. They publish the excellent Journal of Theology, Logia. They publish the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatic Series. They provide conferences for Lutheran pastors around the world. We're talking today with a great apologetics book, Cold Case Christianity, with its author, Jim Warner Wallace. And Jim, I wanted to ask this question, and we failed to do it at the beginning. Are you still a practicing homicide detective?
No, what I did, I retired last year at the end of my last case, and I kind of extended my career for a bit to handle that last case, which had just appeared on Dateline about maybe 2 weeks ago on Sunday night. And now what I do is I just volunteer with the same a team of prosecutors at the DA's office. I just met with them on Friday. So now I do work with the same team, but I don't need the income. So I've got a pension. So basically, what's great about not doing it on income is that if you can't make it that day, you just call and say, hey, I can't make it.
So now you're doing some selective consulting, would you say?
A little bit more flexible. Yeah, absolutely. So, but these are still the same guys who I've worked with for the last 15 to 18 years. We've become very good friends. We trust each other. And so we're working on a couple of really big cases that are really interesting.
Yeah. Super. I'm sure that experience is useful to them. Tell us, for how long did you do this detective work, Jim?
I worked as a police officer for 26 years. And I think that the last maybe 15 or 16, well, probably the last 18, I was working in investigations, but we actually opened a full-time cold case team. A lot of agencies in Southern California have cold cases. They work as a collateral duty, and I did that too for a number of years. So I've been working cold cases for a lot of years, but I was also working other cases. Then toward the end, I was working nothing but cold cases. So, yeah, that's how that worked out.
Excellent. You know, there's so many correlative things that you point out in your book, and we've got a direct link to that on the website of this archive show, between cold case detective cases and apologetics. The one that really struck me, and I think the listener would find this fascinating, Jim, share with us about hang on every word, forensic statement analysis.
Well, when I was first looking at this, I was a skeptic, and I was a pretty adamant, vocal atheist. Most of my friends who were Christians I worked with knew me that way, and they were patient with me. But I was not the kind of person you could have a voice with on this issue. But I got interested in the Gospels only because I found some elements of the Gospels were persuasive in the sense that they contained characteristics that were similar to the kinds of multiple eyewitness accounts that I would read about in my casework. If I've got more than one person seeing the same event, they're typically going to provide me with details that puzzle together in a particular way. And I started to see some of the same kind of puzzle features of the Gospels, so I decided to test them. And one of the ways I tested them is to kind of use a modified version of forensic statement analysis. In forensic statement analysis, what you're doing is you're asking your suspect, hey, do me a favor and write everything you did yesterday, the day of the murder. Write down everything you did from the time you got up in the morning to the time you went to bed. And we give them one piece of paper that can only use one side. It's got 24 lines. They're able to write out everything they did. And typically, they can only use an ink pen. You can't use a pencil. So any modifications, any changes, we can see that. And then we have a number of criteria that we use when we examine the statement of the person who's writing the account, including their use of pronouns, their use of verbs, certain kinds of verbs, their use of tense, their compression of time, the expansion of time. There's just a number of different things we look at. And it really is insightful. This is as much an art as it is a science. Trust me, it's something you learn, you get better at. You make mistakes when you first start. You get better as you do it more often. But toward the end, I was using this on my suspects, and it was really helpful to determine whether they're being deceptive in some way, and even about what time of day they're being deceptive. So I decided to use forensic statement analysis on the Gospel of Mark because I had read that Papias in the first century made a claim that Mark was scribing for the Apostle Peter. So Peter's this eyewitness who sees all these things and it reports them and starts preaching about them in Rome. And Mark, sitting during these sessions, began to scribe out Peter's preaching. So I thought, well, if that's the case, we ought to see some distinct feature of Mark's gospel in which Peter seems to be an influence or has some fingerprint, of Peter's involvement compared to other gospel accounts. And sure enough, you do see that when you, and I've written an entire chapter about where I think you see the fingerprints of Peter in Mark's gospel. And to me, it's very telling. And it was just a one more piece of a larger cumulative case that I try to make in Cold Case Christianity for the reliability, the historical reliability of these accounts. And in the end, Rod, I'll tell you, part of the problem we have when assessing these as atheists is that if these were just about a sweet guy named Jesus, kind of like, you know, Buddha, a guy who lived in the ancient past, who made some proverbial statements of wisdom, well, nobody would doubt the accounts of the first century that we find in the Gospels. What people don't like about the Gospels is the supernatural elements that are in the Gospels, where you have a Jesus who claims to be God, there's a claim about the miraculous supernatural events, a claim about the resurrection. These are the things that most people like me, as an atheist, who are philosophical naturalists, I was a committed philosophical naturalist, I would have rejected any supernatural element. So when you get to a place where you feel like, wow, you know, based on every other criteria that I could assess an eyewitness, these things pass in terms of their reliability. What do I do with the supernatural accounts? Do I just kind of, like the Jesus movement scholars, where you just, you know, these folks just kind of cut out all the supernatural? You know, you have to decide what to do with the supernatural. And I think in the end, if the skeptic is honest and he looks at these accounts and just assess them initially without the supernatural elements, they're going to come away very, very committed to the reliability of accounts that seem to be very substantially verified by archaeology and by other writings of the ancient past. And, I mean, there's just all the different criteria I use in the book. These things pass the test. What we have to do is make a decision about what it is that's controlling our conclusion. Is the presupposition against anything supernatural really the tail that wags the dog? Because if it is, no matter what I show you, no matter what I say, if you're committed that there's no God, there's no such thing as supernatural elements, there are events, there's no such thing as miracles, then you're just committed to that conclusion, and no matter what I show you, I'm not going to have any success. But that is not a matter of whether or not the evidence is good. That is a matter of whether or not your presupposition is biasing your conclusion.
In the same way, I believe in trials, because I've talked to some people that I know I wouldn't want on the jury with me or on a jury if I was the defendant, because they've already made up their mind without her hearing the evidence. And they even admit that there's other evidence that they are assured they could find, but they don't have. And that's scary to me, because we know our judicial system says you're only to make the judgment based on the evidence that's handed, presented to you. And you can't, is it fair to say, Jim, that with the case of Mark, which I think is an excellent example of this forensic statement analysis, that it's not just one isolated example that you find forensically of what Mark does with Peter, but it's the whole culmination, just like in a trial, the jury that I was on, it had a preponderance of circumstantial evidence that not any one of them would convict, but the preponderance of it stacks up and made me feel beyond a reasonable doubt that the conclusion was there. Let me just give the listener some examples here that you've picked out in Mark's gospel. It's the only one that does not refer to Peter as Simon Peter together, and it, right, and it refers to Peter more than any other account. For instance, Mark refers to Peter 26 times, and Matthew, which is a longer gospel, only has 3. And it goes on and on. And is that the case where when you have the circumstantial evidence that we started off with in cold cases, one of them doesn't mean much, but when it all stacks up, it gives a preponderance. And if you would, too, I would just really touched by the example you used from the cold case world of Scott, if you remember that one.
Well, of course, you know, part of this, Rod, I've changed all the names of all my real cases, and I made a point of saying that early on in the book, that I've changed the names of my,
So Scott Taylor really isn't the real guy, right?
Exactly, because I didn't want it. Some of these cases I'm talking about.
So Scott Taylor, you don't have to worry.
Yes, we're still active at the time I wrote the book, and others, you know, I didn't want to have to go through the families and try to, you know, connect with all these families and explain that I'm writing a book. But my point here is that, yeah, I think that what you said is spot on. When we put together cumulative indirect cases of many, I call this death by a thousand paper cuts. Any one of these little pieces of evidence really doesn't amount to much. And you could certainly find a way to explain away any of the other small things. The fact that Mark mentions Peter more than the other gospel authors really could be explained away by some other explanation. But what happens is when you get 8, 9, 10 different things that all point to the same reasonable inference, now it's harder to explain away all 10. It's just either a really bizarre coincidence that, you know, these 80 pieces of evidence happen to make my defendant look guilty, or it's just that he's really guilty, and that's why he's the one common causal factor that explains all 80 pieces of evidence. It's not 80 different wild explanations that have to line up perfectly like the perfect lining up of the stars in order to make my defendant look guilty. It's just that he's the one common causal factor and why all these 80 things point toward him. And so that's how we make cumulative cases. And this is part of the skill set I'm trying to teach, not only in this book. I've got another book coming out in August called God's Crime Scene, where we're making a case for the existence of God. Same thing. These are cumulative cases. The more pieces we have pointing to the same reasonable inference, the more confidence we can have that our inference is sound. And that's really all we're trying to do here is to ask ourselves, do we think we have a reasonable inference that is the best explanation for the evidence as we see? Now I can tell you that words do matter. And I saw this. I pick through everything in the scriptures. You know, I'm constantly asking myself the question, what words are Mark using, or Matthew, or what does Luke use when he's doing the Gospel of Luke? What kinds of words is he picking? And then I'm also asking the question, what kinds of alternative words could he have picked, but instead he chose to use that word? Because that matters. When you've got, you know, 8 different ways you could explain something, but you choose to explain it this way, I want to know why. And this is what we do with suspects all the time, right? I mean, you have a large body of ways you could say it, and then instead, you know, so I use the example of my own experience. What'd you do last night? I took my beautiful wife, Susie, to dinner. We've been married for 36 years. We had a great time. Well, I've told you a lot about my wife. I've given you her name. She's beautiful. We've been married 36 years. We even had a great time. I could have said, and this often happens, I took my wife to dinner. Now, maybe that means nothing, especially if I'm just short about all my responses. But if I'm very descriptive when describing my friends and my activities with my friends, but then I get to my wife and I limit it, I might even say, I took the wife to dinner. The wife, not even a possessive pronoun that attaches her to me. It's just the wife. Well, those things matter to me. If you're calling my friend John, my friend Jim, my friend Susan, and then I get to my wife and I say, the wife, why do I need to distance myself from my wife? I hope your wife's still alive, because if she's not, you're a good suspect. Already, you've given me some clues, some verbal clues about your relationship. Of course, that one statement, as you said, means nothing. But if I've got 70 statements that are all similarly given to me, then I can start to ask the question, hey, what's up with that? Why is this the response that I'm seeing here? So this is the kind of thing I'm looking for when I assess statements. And when I read through the Gospels, this was very powerful for me. Even so much in the first chapter of Luke, where Luke tells Theophilus that he is going to write an orderly account of the things he has heard from the eyewitnesses. That was very interesting to me, because if you're going to say you're writing an historical account for Theophilus, do you really need to tell me that it's orderly? In other words, isn't history going to be in the right chronological order? But Luke makes a point of saying to Theophilus, I'm giving you an account that's in the correct chronological order. Well, that's because there's another account out there, the Gospel of Mark, that Papias, the bishop in the first century we talked about earlier, he says that when he wrote that account underneath Peter's teaching, he was very careful to be accurate, but not so careful about order. Peter didn't preach in those kinds of things. Peter preached in themes. So Mark's gospel, according to Papias, is accurate, but not in the correct chronological order. Now suddenly Luke's statement makes sense because he's talking to Mark. He quotes Mark more than anyone else in his own gospel. And now you can see how that word for chronological order makes sense, given you didn't need to say it, but you chose to say it. Why? Because you know there's another account that precedes yours that's not chronologically orderly. So now you made a point of saying that about your own. And it's a careful assessment of the use of words and what could have been said but wasn't that I think leads us to these kinds of conclusions.
Yes, and I very much appreciated that you pointed out that Peter's preaching style, and you point out found in Acts 1 and Acts 10, consistently omits details of Jesus' private life, and he primarily zeroes in on Jesus' public life, death, resurrection, ascension, and Mark followed that rough outline in his gospel. So another bit of that circumstantial evidence that Peter was the pen for, Mark was the pen for Peter. Before we go, though, I have to ask you to share that story with Scott Taylor and this Hang on Every Word, because I was captivated by that. And then you led me into the Gospel of Mark. And I want the listener, Jim, to hear this careful way that the Lord kind of led you from cold case work to, the New Testament documents.
Right. Well, I had a case that was many years ago, and it was a 1980s case in which a man killed a woman, and later on, when asked about it, asked how he felt about the victim's murder, he had a number of choices he could have described to us. This is why I say looking at alternatives and what you could say, but what you didn't choose to say is so powerful for us. So, for example, he could have said, "Well, I'm shocked that somebody had killed her. I mean, it surprised me." Or he could have said, "It's tragic. Have you guys got any leads? Have you found the killer?" And he could have said, "Hey, I know we had some problems, as we were dating or whatever. But man, I was just destroyed when I learned about her murder." There's lots of things you could say, but here's what he ended up saying, And we asked him, "Hey, let me ask you, Scott, how do you feel about her death? Did you have any feelings about it one way or the other?" That was our question. And given that question and all the alternative ways he could have said it, he said, "Well, I was sorry to see her dead. We didn't always get along. It's never a good thing to see anyone die." And this little expression may seem like nothing to people who read it, but when I first heard it, I thought, whoa, hang on. That's a very unusual way. We know he was the last person as her killer to see her alive, and then he eventually, at the end of it, saw her dead. But isn't it interesting that he used words that expressed what he actually, did, what he actually saw? Now, again, I think those words isolated by themselves don't have a lot of meaning. But when you saw how they were assembled with all the other statements in his interview with us, they were very powerful. And it was very obvious to a jury looking at this that he was giving us little clues, little things that, he was just choosing words that gave away who he really was and what he had really done. And those are the kinds of things that I think we look for. And again, it's as much art as it is science, and I would never look at any of those statements in isolation. You're always trying to remember the context. So I think when I looked at the Gospels and I assessed them under those four major criteria we always talk about, right? Are they early enough to have been written by eyewitnesses? Have they been verified in some way by outside sources, internal evidences? The third thing, of course, is have they changed over time, or have they been honest and accurate without alteration? And the last thing is, do they possess bias? Those are the four criteria that we use with any eyewitness, and that was the criteria I used on the Gospels as a skeptic, not to try to prove them wrong. That was not my goal. I was just interested, and I knew what eyewitness accounts, how you could test them, so I decided to test these. And as I did that, they held up in those four areas, and that's what led me eventually to say, okay, well, what do I do with this guy named Jesus? Because if these are accurate accounts that are reliable, something crazy happened in the first century that we really need to, and as C.S. Lewis says, if this isn't true, then this is of no importance. But if it is true, it's of infinite importance. The one thing it cannot be is moderately important. Either it's false, get rid of it, or it's true and it changes everything. And that's where the conclusion I came to as well.
I think that's a formidable statement that C.S. Lewis gave to us. And so is it transferable for us Christian apologists and would-be apologists, Jim, that we should be hanging on every word that we read in the Bible, and as you have pointed out so articulately for us, that, you know, why did they use that word and not some other word? And that's, you know, like you said with Scott, that's amazing that they use those words. That's very useful to us in our apologetics, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think, again, it's just one tool in your call-out bag. That's why I tried to give 10 tools first before I went into those testing the eyewitnesses. So I think this is one tool, you know, just hanging on every word, but understanding how to separate artifacts from evidence, how to test your witnesses, how to think circumstantially, how to avoid presuppositional bias, how to infer using abductive reasoning. I've tried to go through all these things that we do as cops, as detectives. These are the tools we use, because all of these, I think, do turn a corner with you then and allow you to assess not only the case for God's existence, but the case for the reliability of the Bible.
We're running out of time, unfortunately, as we always seem to do. And so we would encourage you, Jim, if I forget when you, your new book comes out, I believe you said August, to let us see that and let us hopefully share that with our audience again. So tell us about chain of custody and why that is critical. I know a lot of times in court cases that I hear and observe, that's sometimes very much a big challenge by the defendant.
You know, absolutely. I mean, this is what happens. Every time you've got any piece of evidence, the question is, well, how do I know that that piece of evidence actually appeared that way at the crime scene 30 years earlier? How do I know that somebody didn't modify it in the last 10 years or wasn't taken out of property and changed or altered, and now I've got some altered piece of evidence in my trial? So we have to show who handled the evidence over the course of that period of time. It was who found it, what did he do with it, who did he give it to, what did they see when they got it, what did they record when they got it, when they tested it, what did they record, how many pictures were taken over the years. And as the more pictures and reports we have over the years of the same piece of evidence as it's being handed from one person to the next, that gives us confidence. This chain of custody from one person, one link to the next link, that gives us confidence that the evidence has not been altered in some way. And in a similar way, we could assess the Gospels. We could ask the simple question, hey, who basically handled this thing over the years? Who was the first writer of this? And how do we know that it wasn't changed along the way? Well, we need as many reports as we can tracing the custody of this document over the years. John writes a gospel. Well, who did he give it to? He actually had three students who received that information from John and started writing immediately about what they received from John. We happen to have their documents. This is Ignatius and Polycarp and Papias. These three authors, we have two of those authors. We still have surviving letters. If you're wondering what was in John's gospel in the first century, you can simply look at the writing of his students to see what they reported they learned from John. A similar approach can be taken with Clement and Linus, the first two pupils of Paul, the Apostle Paul, to see if anything has changed in the letters of Paul. We could look to the same thing with Peter through the Roman, North African bishopry, which he established and hand trained all the way through the leaders in the North Africa. So you can look at this across the Roman Empire based on a chain of custody from each of the disciples and their students, and get picture after picture after picture of the Gospels to see if they have been distorted over the years. And what you discover when you do this is that from the very earliest of times, there aren't any distortions. The virgin birth is not a late legend. The resurrection is not a late legend. All the supernatural elements are not late legends. These are the earliest claims of the earliest students of the eyewitnesses, the deity of Christ, the miracles of Christ, the preaching of Christ, the resurrection of Christ, the ascension of Christ. All of these things are the earliest teaching of the students of the eyewitnesses. So if you're asking yourself the question, how do we know that this stuff isn't just legendary accounts that were added? Well, we do know that. We can answer that question because we happen to have a very good chain of custody over the years that we can examine.
Well, you've done such a good job of, bringing this all forth in such a readable way and a fascinating way, tying it to cold case homicides that you as detective investigated over your career and continue to consult on. And it's just a marvelous, fascinating book, Jim. So we thank you for writing it. We thank you for being our guest today on Cross Defense and Book Talk. And we look forward to talking with you later on in the summer with your new book. God's blessings as you continue to serve the Lord. We're so glad that you're on our team.
Well, thank you, sir, for having me. I'm so grateful to be here.
Our blessings, and we look forward to talking with you again. Jim Warner Wallace, Cold Case Christianity. Check it out on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all your other sites. Buy it for yourself. Buy it for your pastor. Buy it for a friend. You'll be blessed by it. Cold Case Christianity, Jim Warner Wallace. That's it for today. We'll see you next time on Cross Defense here on Worldwide KFUO.